Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe, titled Which Future for Democracy in a Post-Political Age? Our speaker is Chantal Mouffe, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Westminster. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Sophia Perez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston University.
I assume that most of you here know who Chantal Mouffe is. She is one of the most important political theorists in Europe today. She is best known for co-founding, along with Ernesto Laclau, what is known in Europe as the Essex School of Discourse Analysis, and for co-authoring, together with Laclau, the book Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, Verso 1985, which is really the founding text in that school. Chantal Mouffe is known for arguing forcefully for a radicalization of democracy or agonistic democracy, perhaps also pluralist agonism. She can tell us more about perhaps which one of those terms is the most appropriate. And she has been a critic of Habermas's conception of deliberative democracy, which she juxtaposes agonistic democracy to. Her work is considered to have inspired various left populist movements, in particular, though not only, Podemos in Spain. And in fact, she recently also authored a book that is based on a conversation with one of the key leaders of Podemos, Íñigo Errejón. Today, she will be speaking on the problem of democracy in a post-political age. So without taking any further of your time, let me allow Chantal to take the word.
Thank you very much for the invitation and for the presentation. So we are going to talk about the future of democracy in a post-political age. When we envisage the nature, the present state of democracy, one of the assertions that we often come across is that our current condition is one of post-democracy. The meaning conveyed by this notion of post-democracy is that modern democracies, while maintaining the facade of formal democratic principles, are increasingly controlled by privileged elites. And that, for instance, because the first one to have brought about this question of post-democracy is, in fact, Colin Crouch, a British sociologist, who in a book called Post-Democracy, and this is where he insists on this problem with post-democracy. I agree with him, but so you are going to see, I think, that there are some aspects that are overlooked by the approach of post-democracy. But basically, he insists, you know, there are, in fact, while all the institutions still exist, the decisions are not taken by privileged elites. The implementation of neoliberal policies has led to the colonization of the state by corporate interests, and crucial political decisions are now taken outside of the democratic political channels. This is the origin of a loss of legitimacy of democratic institutions, loss which manifests itself in a growing phenomenon of depoliticization. Here I want to insist, in fact, that my reflection is basically elaborated on the basis of the European experience. No, I think that some aspect might be also convergent with the US, but it's really a reflection starting from the European situation. And I mean, this, of course, is a phenomenon of depoliticization, is something which is very clear in Europe. And in fact, this is something which, as we are going to say, something which is beginning to change. But basically, when I speak of post-political age, I speak of this point and moment of despolitization. And therefore, this is important, because it is a growing phenomenon, and I'm going to show in a moment that it's in reaction against that right-wing populist parties are developing. So I agree with many aspects of the analysis of post-democracy, particularly the fact that, you know, no political decisions are taken by outside the political channel. But I think that when we examine the reason for this phenomenon, and particularly for the consequence of this phenomenon, which is this depoliticization, and then we envisage, and I think this is for me what is really important, how this tendency can be reversed. I think it's important then to stress the role of the parties of the left, the role that they've played in this process of disaffection with democratic politics. And that's not something that the analysis of Colin Croix, for instance, take into account. In a book, in fact, which was published between the democratic paradox and agonistic, which is called On the Political, I have examined the reason for what I call, in that book, the post-political perspective, which has become dominant in liberal democratic societies. And I have argued that this is linked to the move towards the center, which in the last decades have been the strategy of social democratic parties, and in Europe, a strategy which under the motto of the third way, which of course was first elaborated for New Labour in Britain by Anthony Giddens. This is clearly the very origin of the post-political perspective. According to that approach, Western societies have entered a second stage of modernity, what they call reflexive modernization. In fact, Tony Giddens is not the only one to defend the view, because in Germany, Ulrich Beck also defended the same view, that we are now in a second modernity. And the characteristic of the second modernity is that the adversarial model of politics, which they say was characteristic the first stage of modernity, or sometimes they refer to that stage as simple modernization, this model has become obsolete, to the adversarial model. Giddens claims that it's no necessary to think beyond left and right. In fact, that's the title of one of his book, and envisage a new type of politics that he called of the radical center, which transcend the old-fashioned left-right divide. So that began in Britain, but such a view was later accepted by other socialist and social democratic parties, as I say, first in Germany with Gerhard Schröder and his Neue Mitte, but then, you know, France, Italy, and it spread, in fact, very much in Europe. And the idea was that social democratic project needed to be modernized, modernized so as to adapt it to a globalized world. And this is what led social democratic parties, or labor parties, or socialist parties, it depends on how they are referred to move themselves to the center, in fact, to present themselves as center-left parties. Well, I think that, in fact, under the pretense of modernizing the social democratic project, what they really did was to abandon it and capitulate to neoliberalism. Convinced that there was no alternative to the current form of globalized financial capitalism, those parties have accepted the framework which had been established by neoliberal hegemony. That was clearly the case in Britain with Tony Blair, who succeeded Margaret Thatcher, but without at all putting into question the neoliberal hegemony that had been established by Thatcher. Having abandoned any attempt to challenge the existing relation of power, social democratic parties now limit themselves to propose ways to humanize, or to speak, neoliberal globalization. I mean, a little bit more of redistribution, but nothing, you know, that would be fundamentally different. And this is why their policies are, in fact, very hard to distinguish from the center-right parties. Center-right, center-left, they present basically the same policies on the basis that there is no alternative to neoliberal globalization. Well, it is my contention that this consensus at the center has very negative consequences for democratic politics.
Indeed, it is the absence of a real choice between clearly distinguishable alternatives which explain, in my view, the current lack of interest for politics, which has produced a drastic fall in participation in elections. That's the first consequence. Another consequence of this conversion between center-right and center-left is that in several countries, such a situation has favored the emergence of right-wing populist parties, whose success is due to the fact that they appear to be the only one that offer an alternative to the existing order. Here I want to say something, because this analysis, well, I did develop it in this book, On the Political, published in 2005. It was a moment, in fact, in which there was not yet so many right-wing populist parties. I mean, we had a very important right-wing populist parties in Austria with the FPÖ, in France, but there were not as many as there are today. And at that moment, I was already, I think, it may be pretentious to say that, but I think that I saw clearly that this was going, this consensus at the center was going to create the terrain for development of right-wing populist parties. And, you know, 10 years later, we can see, well, that has exactly been the case, because now we've got right-wing populist parties in all countries in Europe. Well, and it seems to me that in the discussion about post-democracy, the role played by this post-political situation and the consequences, the political consequences, is not sufficiently taken into account. Of course, it is necessary to grasp the transformation of the capitalist system, which have provided the economic condition for the success of neoliberal globalization. And that was, you know, the center of the post-democracy as been seen by Colin Crouch. But that does not automatically explain the reason for the disappearance of a vibrant democratic debate, a debate about the different ways in which social relations and public institutions could be organized. And this is, I think, where the parties of the left need to be, you know, put their role need to be criticized. By failing to acknowledge that politics is intrinsically partisan, and that democratic politics requires what I've called an agonistic debate, a more conflicting project, and a choice between real alternatives, the consensual politics of the third way is in fact contributed to the disaffection with politics, which is at the core of the post-democratic condition. When citizens feel that they cannot have a say in the fundamental decision which concerns their common affair, and that political questions are dealt with by experts, because they are, of course, considered of a technical nature, then democratic institutions are emptied of their substance and their legitimacy is threatened. Elections are reduced to providing a rubber stamp for measures which are imposed by a variety of actors whose interests are not publicly accountable. And in fact, we could say that the democratic process loses its raison d'être. That, of course, is what, you know, the term post-democracy refers to. To be sure, our societies still claim to be democratic, but what's the meaning of democracy in our post-political times? Scrutinizing the nature of liberal democracy in my book, The Democratic Paradox, I have brought to the fore the tension existing between these two ethico-political principles, liberty and equality. Liberal democracy, I contend, should be understood as the articulation between two different traditions. On one side, there is the liberal tradition, liberal in the political sense, of the rule of law, division of power, individual rights, and on the other side, the democratic tradition of popular sovereignty, and which privileges the idea of equality. In fact, the Canadian political theorist C.B. McPherson has shown how through this articulation, which it was established in the 19th century, and that he showed that in a book called The Life and Times of Liberal Democracy. So through this articulation, liberalism was democratized, he said, and democracy was liberalized. And this is, of course, what is really, when we speak of our when we speak here about democracy, in fact, we speak about a very specific model of democracy, which is the Western model, and which is precisely this articulation between the liberal and the democratic tradition. But here, of course, what's important is to realize that there is always some kind of tension between the exigencies of liberty and the exigencies of equality. That is, that they can never be perfectly reconciled. Say, a perfect equality and a perfect liberty, that cannot be exist. There's always one value which is a lexical, you know, privileged role. However, and here I think that it's important to see that this tension can be understood, or us, for instance, Carl Schmitt proposed, it's a contradiction that will put into question the, you know, the success of liberal democracy, of this articulation of democracy, or it could, in fact, be understood as, and that's the argument I make in the democratic paradox, some kind of tension. Tension which I see as very productive, because it is the place where pluralism can really be exercised. So they can never be perfectly put into reconcile. There is always a tension. And, of course, this tension is precisely what I call the agonistic debate. You know, because there are always different hegemonic projects that can be linked to either the dominance of liberty or the dominance of equality. And, in fact, if we see the evolution of the democratic politics since the time in which this articulation was established, and that's during the 19th century, as Macpherson shows, we see that there are moments in which there was a predominance of the liberal logic, at the same time predominance of the democratic logic, and of course another way to express that will be so that this distinction can be transposed in terms of the left and the right. So there is always one element which is dominant. But what was important is that tension was always problem with our present condition, and this is why we really can call of post-democratic, is that this tension does not exist anymore. It has been eliminated because of the almost total predominance of the liberal logic. The liberal logic, the idea is really the main principle, the principle of liberty. And liberty here understood again in a way which is very specific to neoliberalism. So everything which, for instance, the liberty of the market, is the liberty of the entrepreneurs. And what is important is that the other element, the democratic element, the element about popular sovereignty, this is something which has been eliminated of the political discourse. So those societies still call themselves democratic, but in fact, all the democratic element of the articulation has been really left aside. Democracy is now understood in terms of the rule of law, defense of human rights, and the idea of popular sovereignty has been declared as being obsolete. Those who resist the rule of the market and who pretend, I mean, ask for a voice, those parties which are going to want to give a voice back to the people, they are denounced as being populist. In my view, this displacement of the democratic tradition by the liberal one is one of the main features of our post-democratic condition. And it is, for instance, clearly visible in the abandon by center-left parties of the struggle for equality. Their main slogans are no about choice, fairness, equity, inclusion, but they take pains to avoid speaking of equality that they consider as too tainted by the equalitarianism of the official socialist ideals that they have repudiated. Deprived of the vocabulary that constituted the backbone of the vision of society of the left, it's not surprising then that the left is incapable of envisaging an alternative to neoliberal globalization. The consequence of this democratic at the center, consensus at the center, is that we are currently witnessing a crisis of representation. I'm going to insist very much on this element, because this consensus at the center deprives democratic citizens of this agonistic debate where they can make their voice heard and choose between real alternatives. So my claim is that without abandoning the consensual politics of the third way, there is no hope of escaping the post-democratic trends, which is at the origin of the progressive irrelevance of democratic institutions. It is necessary to fight against the blurring of the line between left and right, because one of the claims of the third way is that this is a big progress, the blurring of the line between left and right. And I mean, I think one can accept that empirically it's true that has happened. But instead of saying that it's a progress or something that is good for democracy because democracy supposedly become more mature, my argument is that no, it's not good for democracy. It is something which in fact could create serious problems because it is precisely what creates the terrain for the development of right-wing populism. So on the political, I insist, no, it's very important to recover this distinction between left and right, because there is a blurring, but it's a blurring which, of course, is a consequence of politics. The fact that there is not enough of this agonistic debate, and it can be reinstalled. And in fact, this is exactly what I was arguing on the political. Till very recently, in fact, this consensus at the center was only put into question through parties of the right. Parties of the right who, of course, articulated their resistance in a xenophobic language. Fortunately, in the last 10 years, I mean, it really began around the 2011, maybe, is the moment when things began to change. We've witnessed a different kind of resistance against this post-democratic, post-political situation, with the multiplication of a series of protest movements. With those protest movements, we are in fact seeing the emergence of much more commendable form of resistance against the post-democratic societies. And in fact, my argument is that if there are so many people in so many places which are now coming to the street, I'm referring here, of course, to what I call the movement of the places, and all those protest movement outside the parties. I mean, for instance, obviously in the U.S., Occupy Wall Street, but the Indignados in Spain, there was a movement like that in Occupy Stop, the Stonewall Stock Exchange in London. I mean, we've seen since the 2011 a multiplication of protests, which are, of course, form of resistance against this post-democratic, but for the first time now from the problem of from the left. And I think that is basically because people feel that they cannot express anymore through the traditional political channels their rejection of this order. In fact, I always refer to a motto of the Indignados in Spain who was saying, we have a vote, but we don't have a voice. And I think it's absolutely the case. If you have a vote, but you are able to vote for a social center-right or center-left parties, which basically offer the same politics, you don't have a voice. And this is, I think, what I call this crisis of representation, which was very much at the origin of those protest movements. Here I want to say that there is a disagreement among people, among political theorists, when it comes to examine what are, in fact, how should we interpret those protest movements. Many theorists, those particularly which are influenced by the exodus approach developed by Michael Arndt and Antonio Negri, see those recent mobilization as a manifestation of what they call the power of the multitude. A multitude which is now constructing a new form of social relation outside traditional institutions. And they celebrate those movements as the realization of the common, and they present their encampments as the prefiguration of what they call absolute democracy. This is a term, you know, which is presented by Art and Negri as what should be, I mean, in fact, is there a way to replace the term communism? They speak absolute democracy. For people like Negri and Art and all the people that they are influencing, those protest movements should be seen as being characteristic of the new form of struggle of the precarious workers, which are typical of post-Fordism. And they argue, for instance, that the Spanish indignados, with their call for democracia realia, what we want is real democracy now, they say they advocate, in fact, not simply direct democracy, because many people even understood those movements as a cry for direct democracy. But the people defending the Exodus approach, they say, no, in fact, direct democracy is still too representative. What they want, in fact, is a democracy in which people really are going to be able to participate in a democracy that they call democracy in actu. And some of them present that as, call it a presentist democracy. You know, so basically what is at stake here is a democracy beyond representation. For them, what they say about the current crisis is a crisis of representative democracy, but representative democracy per se. And this is, you know, what the point I want to put into question. Presentist democracy, in their view, is the opposite of representative democracy. So it is, and this is what those protest movements are fighting for. Presentist democracy is a matter of collective political practice without any claim to government. They are against any form of representation altogether. And they say that they, in fact, express a total rejection of liberal representative democracy. No. So that's an interpretation that has been presented of the rise of those protest movements. Well, my interpretation follows a different line. And this is, for instance, the question that I defend in quite a few chapters of this book, Agonistic. In my view, understood as refusal of the post-political order, this, for me, this is what they are, these protests can be read as a call for a radicalization of liberal democratic institutions, not for their rejection. What they exact are better, more inclusive form of representation. And to satisfy their demand for voice, of course, existing representative institutions have to be transformed. A new one needs to be established as to create the condition of an agonistic confrontation where the citizen will be offered real alternative. So, of course, it's not something that requires for new form of representation, but it's not a rejection of representation per se. And this is what I think that such a confrontation seen in that term of radicalization of democracy requires not a strategy of desertion from existing institutions, but a strategy of engagement with those institutions in order to profoundly transform them. And this is what I call a strategy of radicalization of democracy. And it requires, and I will come to that later, the emergence of a progressive project that will be able to offer an alternative to the post-political liberal consensus, which is dominant in center-left parties. You know, so really, what is at stake here is there is a crisis of representation, but should the problem be seen as a total rejection of representative democracy? In fact, people in the line of Art and Negri say that representative democracy is an oxymoron, so real democracy requires total rejection of representation, or should we, and that I call that a strategy of withdrawal from institution, or should we in fact think of more of strategy of engagement with institution in order to make representative institution more representative? And that, in my view, requires precisely that when people go to vote, they've got the possibility of a real choice. So there is an agonistic debate. So this, of course, is very different political strategy. I think that one can refer to this emergence of protest movement. We can speak of and in fact, this is something that I use a term, sort of citizen awakening. And we, of course, saw that in Europe, but also in the US. And it's most, one must realize that in most places it was really short-lived. But nevertheless, it was important because it broke with the post-political consensus. And in fact, it did have some effect. For instance, I think that even if Occupy Wall Street in the US never led very far, they created a terrain that might have been propitious for the development of the Sanders movement. And at least what they definitively did was to put the question of equality in the back on the agenda. You know, so, of course, they did not agree. And in fact, they did not have any demand. So, yeah, but something was state after that. In the case of Spain, of course, it's very different because you've got the Indignados was, in fact, later followed by Podemos. But even in places where those movements did not develop into something political, like it was also the case of Nuit Debout in France, for instance. So I am very ambiguous with respect to those movements because I think that obviously something which is positive, but on their own, if they don't articulate with some form of institutional, you know, organization, then they are not going to have really important effect. For instance, we could see in the case of the U.S., well, if we accept, I don't know if you accept my claim, that Occupy Wall Street plays an important role, let's say a certain role in the creation of, you know, the possibility of emergence of the Bernie Sanders movement, we all see that. Well, it is exactly at the moment when there is this conversion between the horizontal and the vertical that things really become political. If you don't have this translation into a more institutional language, then you don't really won't have any important transformation. So this citizen awakening, and as a consequence that a taboo was broken. I mean, in the post-political consensus about the emergence of a break. And in fact, the question of equality, and as I was saying in a moment, was put into an agenda. However, I think that we need to insist, and that's what I was, you know, saying, that the articulation to effectively challenge neoliberal hegemony, it is crucial that those energies that have erupted in those different movements are not going to be diverted towards wrong alley. And I think that it is what happens when representative institutions are seen as the main target of the protest. There is no denying that representative institutions are in crisis in their present form. But I do not believe that the solution resides in the establishment of a non-representative democracy, or that, for instance, extra-parliamentary struggles are the only vehicle for making democratic advances, because this is also, you know, some view that is frequently found. That's no point in working through the institution. Only extra-parliamentary movement can make a difference. Of course, such a view is very popular among many people in the left. And this is, I think, is because it chimes with the view, which is fashionable among certain sectors of the left, that the multitude could auto-organize itself and avoid taking power and becoming state. Personally, I think that to find what I would call an anti-political approach among the activists which are involved in the various movements is something which is worrying because it forecloses the possibility of designing an adequate strategy for their struggle. When representation is seen as the problem, then the aim cannot be to engage with current institutions to make them more representative and more accountable, but of course the objective is going to be to discard them entirely. The objective of the movement is, of course, visualized in terms of an exodus from the given form of democracy on the ground that attempting to transform existing institutions is vain and that representative democracy has to be relinquished. Many among those who reject representation, I think they do that because they identify representative democracy with its current post-democratic form and with the current working of the parliamentary system. They do not see that the problem concerns the way representative institutions function at the moment. In my view, what needs to be challenged is the lack of alternative which is offered to the citizen, and not the very idea of representation. I contend that a pluralist democratic society cannot exist without representation. And for that, I have several arguments. First, I would say that anti-essentialist approach, and of course, this is the approach that we developed with Ernesto Laclau in Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, the Essex School to which it was referred before, the idea that identities are never given. Let's say the social space is a discursive space. You don't encounter identities already there given. Identities are always the result of a discursive construction. You know, that's the fundamental thesis of the Essex School, not the discursive construction of reality. So identities are never already given. They are always produced through processes of identification. And this process of identification is a process of representation. It is through representation that collective political subjects are created. They do not exist beforehand. I mean, that in the case of populism is very important because it means that the people is just not there, something that you know exists to be represented. What is there is the population, but the population is a sociological notion, it's not a political one. The people, understood as a political category, is always constructed discursively. But so for that matter, so is it true for all forms of identities and certainly for the all form of political identities, which are necessarily collective identities. So another way to put it is that every assertion of a political identity is thereby interior, not exterior, to the process of representation. Right? So you don't have identity that need to be representation and not representation of something which is, exists independently. The process of representation is process of creation of identities. So that's a first argument for which I think that to think of democracy without representation it's not possible. But secondly, in a democratic society where pluralism is not envisaged in the harmonious anti-political form, because of course there are different forms of pluralism. There is the liberal understanding of pluralism, which is, well, there are of course a multiplicity of values and point of view, and we will not be able to adopt them all, but it's basically for empirical motive, no? Because life is too short, we only have 24 hours. But for somebody that will see society from outside, you know, the point of view of Sirius, as it's sometimes called, that person would see all those different values constituting some kind of harmonious ensemble. So that means that is that I call that a pluralism without antagonism. So this is basically the liberal view of pluralism. But there is another view of pluralism, and this is the one that you know I personally belong to, which is the one we find in Nietzsche or in Max Weber. We speak of the polytheism of value, the war of the god, and insist on the fact that all those values can never be reconciled. There was, if you've got pluralism, you necessarily will have antagonism. And this is, of course, what I'm the argument I'm referring to here. You know, if we start from a view that what is for me the political really view of pluralism, you know, that pluralism entails the ever-present possibility of antagonism, then of course we rely on that representative institution by giving form to this division of society. They play a crucial role in allowing for the institutionalization of the conflictual dimension. That's, for me, is another reason why, you know, we can't have pluralist democracy without representation. But here I want to insist that something which is quite important, this putting, you know, allowing for the institutionalization of the conflictual dimension requires that there exists an agonistic confrontation. If you don't have an agonistic confrontation, then of course this conflictual dimension cannot be institutionalized. And in my view, what constitutes the central problem with our current post-political model is precisely the absence of such an agonistic confrontation, you know, which is of course how I define the post-political condition. And of course, this is not going to be remedied through purely horizontalist practices, which is of course what the other perspective pretends. But here I want to say something because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not at all arguing here that the type of activism, you know, which takes place in those movements in the horizontal level, that's something that is no place in an agonistic democracy. In fact, I am convinced that the variety of, sometimes they are called civil society struggle, and the multiple form of activism that, you know, exists around them, that's valuable, not only to raise consciousness and to bring to the fore issues that are neglected, because this is a very, very fertile terrain, you know, to bring to the fore those issues. So I think they are very valuable. But also because they provide realm for the cultivation of different social relations. So I think we need to acknowledge the importance of this dimension. What I contend is something different. It's not that they are not valuable. What I contend is that those practices, besides the fact that they always entail a dimension of representation, and to say that this is not it's not part of representation, that's not true. I mean, they always have got an element of representation. But more importantly, is that those practices cannot provide a substitute for representative institutions. And that it is necessary to establish a synergy between those practices and other more institutional form of struggle. If the protest movement refuses to establish alliances with traditional channels deemed as being intrinsically impervious to democratic transformation, then the radical potential will be lost. And this is something which I think is for me quite important. And in fact, it's part of debate that is taking place. Just to take the case of Spain, for instance, well, you know, the people who are, of course, the indignados were very much against those forms of representation. You know, they did not want any contact. And when Podemos arise, as Inigo and Aragon explained very well in the book that we did together, I mean, Podemos is not the parties of the indignados, and many of the people of indignados were not at all in agreement with the fact that, you know, some form of institutionalization will take place. In fact, there are still a debate today in Spain among the people who say, oh, Podemos is sold out, you know, no, only the pure horizontalist practices are important. So it is a debate which is still important in the left, you know, the debate between horizontalism versus verticalism. For me, it's really, if we are thinking of having some impact, you know, it is necessary to transform institutions, it's necessary to articulate this dimension with some form of channeling toward the institution, some form of, for instance, in Podemo they call that the development of a war machine, you know, an electoral war machine. So this is something which I mean is important. So let's come now to left-wing populism. So far I've argued that to address the crisis of representative democracy, what is called for the formulation of a progressive project offering an alternative to the current post-democratic condition. Condition which, I remind you, is the product of the hegemony of neoliberalism. Well, it's not the place to enter into the content of such a project, but I'd like to say something about the kind of political movement that the success of such a project requires. And here my claim is that it should take what I call the form of a left-wing populism. Here I insist on something, and I can't develop that here. But when I speak, when I use the term populism, of course I do not use it in the term in which is used by the people who want to denigrate it, not demagogy. Here I follow the definition which is given by Ernesto Laclau. For him, populist, he say, is the way to establish a political frontier, is the way to establish a distinction between us and them, which of course is what politics is about, and it consists in establishing the us, them, in terms of the people against the establishment, the elite, the oligarchy. That's what populism is about. You know, and in fact, this is, I think that in our condition of post-democracy, if we want to re-establish, you know, the democratic core of liberal democracy, it can only be done today through the development of a left-wing populist movement that is constructing the frontier in a populist way. And here, of course, I'm saying that because there are some people who will also say, yes, we need to reestablish the distinction between left and right. They will agree with me that, you know, we need to fight against post-politics. But they consider that one can still reestablish it to create parties, make parties of the left really, really recover their identity. So nothing really new is they still, for instance, need to establish the frontier in the traditional way in which it is established between left and right. And here my argument is that this does not work anymore because of transformation of capitalism under, you know, the neoliberalism. There are many in the sense that, for instance, it's not only as far as you are workers in a factory that you are affected or submitted to the logic of capitalism. We are all of us, in a sense, you know, really subjective to the logic. So there is the us of the collective will that is going to be organized in a left-wing way is much more transversal. It can bring together around the idea of a what can call a collective will of people, many more groups than the groups which were traditionally associated with the left. And also, I think that, and here I've already referred to that, what need is to establish a synergy. So it just cannot be under the form of the traditional party, even if this party is radicalized. You know, we need to try another form of organization, more of the time of what can be called a party movement, you know, in the sense of establishing a synergy between the movement, social movement and the party form. So this is definitively one of the question which is new about the left-wing populist project. But I think what's important to realize here is that what's at stake in this left populist project is the creation of a collective will thanks to the articulation of what we call in hegemony socialist strategy a chain of equivalence among a series of democratic demands. Democratic demands that now exist, there are a multiplicity of democratic demands existing in our societies, and they need to be, you know, brought together, articulated together under the creation of collective will. But as I insist here again, a collective will that will be transversal, you know, that will not be expressing the interests of people because of their place in the relation of production. You know, because this, of course, the difference between a populist way to construct the frontier and what would be the traditional Marxist way is not because Marxists construct the frontier between, you know, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Today, political project that want to really radicalize democracy cannot construct the frontier in that way. It must construct a frontier which is much more transversal, and this is what I call, you know, a populist frontier. In my view, the only way to fight against the rise of anti-European feeling and to stop the growth of right-wing populist parties that excite those feelings is by uniting European citizens around a new vision that will be presented precisely by a left-wing populism a project for Europe, and a project that could give them hope of a democratic future. Establishing at the European level a synergy between left parties and social movement around such a vision could make possible the emergence of a collective will aiming at a radical transformation of the current hegemonic order. And I am convinced that without the development of left populist movement able to mobilize people's hope and passion towards a more just and equalitarian society, there is a serious risk that right-wing populist parties will succeed in occupying this terrain. And in that case, I'm afraid that what expects us is much worse than the current post-democracy. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Chantal Mouffe, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Westminster. Tonight's lecture was titled Which Future for Democracy in a Post-Political Age? And was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Sophia Perez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.